All right, welcome to the deep dive. Today we're going deep on a case out of Colorado, People v. Cordova. This case is really interesting, I think, because it brings up some bedrock principles of the U.S. legal system.
Yeah.
And it's also a good case study, I think, for law students to kind of think about, you know, procedural rules and sentencing and some other interesting concepts like alternative liability.
Mm-hmm.
So To tackle this case, we've got a couple of legal briefs, specifically a perplexity analysis and a standard brief, and we've also got some expert commentary to kind of guide us through it.
Right.
And really, our mission here is to sort of extract the core insights from all this material, and think about, okay, so what does this mean for somebody who's studying law,
mm-hmm.
or maybe practicing law, right? Like, what are the takeaways here in terms of how procedural rules actually work?
Mm.
How habitual offender laws work in practice,
right.
And then this sort of interesting kind of puzzle of alternative liability. So let's.
Yeah, you know what's really fascinating about this case is although it centers on one person's specific legal battle,
mm-hmm.
the issues that it raises have a lot of broader implications for anybody who's studying or working within the U.S. legal system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's especially interesting to kind of trace how these seemingly small details during a trial can end up having a huge ripple effect, especially mm-hmm. when they intersect with, you know, well-established legal doctrines and sentencing guidelines.
All right. So let's jump into the story here.
Mm-hmm.
So we have Christopher Cordova, who was facing numerous charges.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately found guilty on 18 counts.
Mm-hmm.
And these included some very serious charges like drug distribution as a repeat offender and sexual assault on a child. And the jury did deliver these guilty verdicts across the board.
Right.
But only 16 signed verdict forms made it into the official record.
Mm.
And that little detail actually becomes important later on.
It does.
So after the trial, Cordova's legal team tried to challenge four of the habitual criminal counts
mm-hmm.
on the basis that the prior convictions that those counts relied upon were invalid.
Mm-hmm.
But the trial court said no to that. Said that this was time barred. Basically, you're too late to bring this up.
Right. They missed their window.
Yeah. So when it came to sentencing, the prosecution wanted a really long sentence, 144 years.
Mm-hmm.
But the trial judge decided to go a different route, at least initially. So for seven of the class, two felony drug convictions, Cordova received a 24-year sentence for each of those,
wow.
totaling 240 years.
Okay.
The judge decided not to multiply those sentences by four under the habitual offender laws.
Interesting.
And as we'll see, this is what the appellate court really took issue with.
Right.
The appellate court ultimately upheld the convictions,
mm.
but they found some errors in the sentencing. So let's dive into the first big legal question here, which is about those missing verdict forms.
Okay.
So can a defendant wait until after the trial is completely over and then challenge the verdict because some paperwork is missing? That's the question.
Yeah, and the answer that the appellate court gave was a resounding no.
Okay.
They found that Cordova had basically waived his right to challenge this because his legal team didn't object during the trial itself.
Mm-hmm.
And this brings up this important concept in procedural law known as the contemporaneous objection doctrine.
Right. So let's unpack that a little bit.
Yeah.
Basically, under Colorado law, and this is common in many jurisdictions,
mm-hmm.
if there's a procedural mistake during a trial, the defendant or their attorney needs to point it out right then there.
Right away.
You can't just wait until after the trial is over.
And see how things shake out.
And then say, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
There was a problem.
Especially if it doesn't go your way.
Yeah. And the reasoning behind this is that it gives the trial court a chance to correct any mistakes
right
then and there.
Fix it on the spot.
And it avoids having to have an appeal.
Yeah,
exactly. Right. A whole new trial. So it's about fairness, but it's also about efficiency in the system.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense.
So in Cordova's case, there were a couple of the things that suggested that he and his legal team had basically accepted the verdict,
mm-hmm.
even though those forms weren't all there. So first of all, the jury had actually verbally confirmed in open court that their verdict was unanimous on all counts. And then Cordova's lawyer had even referred to the guilty counts.
Mm-hmm.
in some of the sentencing memos that they filed with the court.
So basically they were acting.
Yeah, it seems like everybody understood what the result was.
Verdicts had been properly rendered.
Yeah, even if all the paperwork wasn't perfect.
Right.
And to really drive this point home, the appellate court quoted one of their own previous rulings that said, a party waives the requirement for signed forms if they fail to object when the verdict is announced.
Okay.
So that's a pretty clear statement.
Very clear.
From the court saying, look, you gotta be on top of these things.
Yeah, I might be paying attention.
Yeah. You can't snooze on a procedural error and then try to bring it up later.
Exactly. Gotta be diligent.
Okay. So let's move on to the second big legal issue here.
All right.
Which is the habitual criminal sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about how the trial court chose not to quadruple Cordova's drug sentences.
Right.
Even though the prosecution was arguing that that was required under the habitual offender laws.
Mm.
So what did the appellate court have to say about that?
Yeah. So the appellate court actually overturned the trial court's decision on this. Mm-hmm. They said, no, those sentences should have been quadrupled.
Okay.
And this comes down to a really important legal principle about how sentencing enhancements work under Colorado law.
So what's the key takeaway here?
The main thing to understand is that Colorado law requires sentencing enhancements to be applied independently.
Okay.
So that means if there are multiple reasons why a sentence can be increased.
Yeah, like for example, if someone is a repeat offender.
Yeah.
And the crime they committed is also a serious felony.
Right.
Those enhancements are generally applied on top of each other.
Okay.
We don't cancel each other out.
No.
Or only the biggest one gets applied.
It's not like picking and choosing.
No.
It's like they all have to like
stacking them up.
Stack up. So in Cordova's case, he wasn't just being sentenced for the current drug offenses.
Right.
He had this prior record that triggered those habitual criminal statutes.
Exactly.
And those are designed to really increase the penalties for people who have a history of criminal behavior.
It's a way for the legal system to kind of acknowledge and respond to that pattern of behavior.
And the appellate court said the trial court messed up by not applying that quadrupling effect on top of the already pretty long sentence.
Yeah. Basically, the trial court thought they had some discretion here.
Thought they could choose not to apply that habitual offender enhancement.
Mm-hmm.
But the appellate court was like, no, the law actually requires it. And so they sent the case back down, what we call a remand, specifically to have the trial court recalculate that sentence and make sure that those habitual offender enhancements were included.
Mm-hmm.
So just to clarify that term remand, that basically means the higher court sends it back to the lower court to fix a specific problem.
Right. In this case, the problem was the sentencing.
Yeah.
And to underscore this, the appellate court's majority opinion said pretty clearly, habitual criminal statutes must be applied independently, not to the exclusion of one another.
Right.
So that's a pretty strong statement.
Yeah, they're not messing around.
About how seriously the courts take these enhancements when the requirements are met.
It's a clear signal that they view these enhancements as mandatory.
Yeah.
When those legal boxes are checked.
Yeah, it's not really up to the judge to decide whether or not they want to.
Right. It takes away some of that judicial discretion.
Apply those.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about something a little bit different that came up in the court's discussion.
Okay.
Which is this alternative liability doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't central to the outcome in Cordova's case.
Right.
But the court did touch on it.
They did.
And it's a pretty interesting concept.
Yeah, it's kind of a brain teaser.
Yeah. So imagine you've got a situation where you know that somebody got hurt.
Okay.
And you know that one of several people did it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't figure out exactly who.
Right.
That's where this alternative liability idea comes in.
Yeah, that's when this doctrine could potentially come into play.
So for our listeners out there, what is alternative liability?
So essentially, alternative liability is a legal concept that can actually shift the burden of proof in these tricky situations.
Yeah.
So instead of the prosecution having to prove beyond a reasonable doubt which specific person caused the harm, the burden can actually shift to the defendants to prove that they didn't do it.
Okay, so that's kind of unusual, right?
It is. It's a little different.
Typically, we think of the burden of proof being on the prosecution.
Right, exactly.
So can you give us like a concrete example to illustrate this?
So let's say we have two hunters.
Okay.
And they're both kind of carelessly firing their shotguns in the direction of a third person.
Okay.
That third person gets hit by a bullet.
Right.
But it's impossible to tell which hunter actually fired the fatal shot.
Mm-hmm.
So under this idea of alternative liability, both of those hunters could be held legally responsible, unless they can each prove that their shot wasn't the one that caused the harm.
So even if we don't know for sure
exactly
which person's bullet hit the victim,
it creates this interesting situation where they're both potentially on the hook.
But on the hook.
Unless it can clear their name.
Unless they can prove that it wasn't them.
Exactly.
Okay. And so how would this apply, like, in a more typical criminal context?
Right. So the court discussed this doctrine in Cordova's case, although it wasn't directly applicable to the charges against him.
Right.
But you can see how it might be relevant in cases that involve accomplices,
right,
or group crimes.
Right.
Like, let's say you have a group of people who commit an assault,
mm-hmm,
and it's unclear which person in that group actually inflicted the most serious injury.
Right.
Alternative liability could potentially be argued in that type of scenario.
Mm.
It's a way for the law to try to deal with situations where you have this collective action that leads to harm.
Right.
But it's really hard to pinpoint exactly who's responsible for which specific part of the harm.
Okay, so before we wrap up our discussion of the legal issues,
mm-hmm,
we did notice something a little bit interesting in preparing for this episode,
mm-hmm,
which was that there was a slight discrepancy between our sources,
okay,
in terms of how they described the appellate court's decision.
Yeah.
So the perplexity analysis suggested that the court affirmed the trial court's judgment.
Right.
Whereas the standard brief indicated remand.
Mm-hmm.
So can you clear that up for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really important point to clarify.
Yeah.
And it highlights how crucial it is,
yeah,
to be thorough in your legal research.
Right.
So the perplexity analysis was partially correct in saying that the appellate court affirmed the trial court's judgment,
mm-hmm,
but that affirmation was specific to the guilty convictions.
Okay.
The standard brief provides a fuller picture, mm-hmm, by noting that the appellate court also reversed the sentence,
mm-hmm,
and remanded the case back down to the trial court for resentencing because of that error with the habitual criminal statute.
Okay, so basically what you're saying is Cordova is still guilty.
That's right.
But his punishment,
mm-hmm,
is going to be
recalculated. Right.
Right. And this really underscores the importance of not just relying on summaries or analyses,
mm-hmm,
but going back to those primary sources.
Right, getting the full picture.
The actual legal documents.
Yeah.
To really make sure you understand what happened.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's wrap things up here.
Right.
What are the key takeaways from People v. Cordova for our listeners?
Okay, so I think the first big takeaway, mm-hmm, is that you got to raise those objections to any procedural errors during a trial.
Right.
You can't wait.
If you don't do it, then you lose your chance.
You snooze, you lose.
Right. Second takeaway is that those habitual criminal sentencing enhancements,
mm-hmm,
those are mandatory.
They are.
When the law says they got to be applied.
When the law says they apply, they apply.
The court doesn't have the discretion,
right,
to just ignore them.
Judges can't just decide not to use them.
Right. And then finally, we have this really interesting concept of alternative liability.
Right, which might not have been central to this specific case, but it illustrates how the burden of proof can shift,
mm-hmm,
in certain types of cases where proving who did what is super difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah, those really tricky situations.
And then I think that little discrepancy we found between our sources,
mm-hmm,
is also a good reminder.
Absolutely.
For everybody to...
Yeah, do your research.
Double check.
Yeah.
Especially when you're dealing with legal cases.
Make sure you...
And really try to go back to those original sources.
Going back to those original sources.
As much as possible.
Okay, so given all of this strictness around the contemporaneous objection rule,
mm-hmm,
and these mandatory sentencing enhancements, what do you think, what are some strategies that defense attorneys can use?
Mm. That's a great question. To try to protect their clients' rights,
mm-hmm,
and advocate for a fair outcome.
You know, I think this case really highlights the importance of being super meticulous,
mm,
and proactive, mm-hmm, in building a defense strategy.
Right.
You gotta be on top of every detail from, mm-hmm, the moment you take on a case.
Yeah.
You know, understanding the procedural rules inside and out,
yeah,
really scrutinizing the prosecution's case for any weaknesses,
mm-hmm,
and really thinking strategically about how you're gonna challenge any sentencing enhancements.
Right.
It's a tough landscape out there.
Yeah.
And knowing the rules is just the first step in being able to navigate it effectively.
All right. So that's People v. Cordova, a case that really illustrates
a lot to think about.
Yeah. Some of the complexities and the challenges of the U.S. legal system.
Absolutely.
So thanks for joining us for this deep dive, and we'll see you next time.
See you then.